Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on this two-hour special edition of News One Now, Black and Blue America, the race crisis, the deaths of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling are at the center of a debate as protests continue to rage all across the country. Speaking of today, President Barack Obama will be in Dallas along with President George W. Bush to speak at a memorial service for the five police officers killed on Thursday after a Black Lives Matter protest. The blame game, five Dallas cops killed by lone gunmen, and somehow an entire movement for justice gets blamed. We'll explain the attacks on Black Lives Matter. Also, policing in our communities. Why is it that some police officers find it so hard to carry out their duties in our neighborhoods, while others thrive at creating trusting relationships with residents? We'll have that very important conversation. Also, looking to heal as the city of Dallas stood waist deep in grief, thousands gathered at a local megachurch for an interfaith prayer service. I was there. We'll bring you a recap. Also, folks, white acknowledgement. More whites are acknowledging, based upon a video, what African Americans have been saying for a long time actually is ringing true. We'll talk to Tim Wise about that. It's time for News One Now on TV One. Folks, in a matter of hours, President Barack Obama and former President George W. Bush will attend a memorial service in Dallas for the five officers killed in an ambush on Thursday. Well, last night, hundreds of people gathered at the Dallas City Hall Plaza to pay their respects to those officers during the Dallas Strong Vigil. A picture of each fallen officer was shown in front of the crowd as a moment of silence was held. People lit candles as bagpipes played and bowed their heads in prayer. Yesterday, Chief Brown, of course, the police chief of Dallas, updated everyone on the investigation surrounding the shootings. Authorities are continuing to download 170 hours of body camera footage from all of the officers who were on the scene. They then plan to date and timestamp all of the video. Next, police plan to review all of the dash cam video from the squad cars. Also, the FBI, they are still analyzing what the initials RB means, written by the shooter Micah Xavier Johnson on the wall during the standoff. First of all, that was written also in blood. The chief also gave more details about the nine officers injured. Four Dallas police officers, three DART officers, and two Dallas Community College officers were wounded. All right, folks, so we'll have that video for just in 1 second. Dallas Police Chief David Brown is firing back, though, at the protesters who are demanding justice for the two men killed by cops, of course, Castile and Sterling. Protests continue again, as I said earlier, all across the country. In Chicago, demonstrators blocked traffic and then came together at Federal Plaza. Now here is more what Chief Brown had to say.
We're asking cops to do too much in this country. We are. We're just asking us to do too much. Every societal failure, we put it off on the cops to solve. Not enough mental health funding. Let the cop handle it. Not enough drug addiction funding. Let's give it to the cops. You know, schools fail. Give it to the cops. 70% of the African American community is being raised by single women. Let's give it to the cops to solve that as well. That's too much to ask. Policing was never meant to solve all those problems. Do your job. We're doing ours. We're putting our lives on the line. The other aspects of government need to step up and help us.
In addition to that, Chief Brown also was highly critical of those saying that if protesters want to change police departments, what they should do is actually join the police force. I want to go to our panel right now. We have attorney Monique Presley, Dr. Greg Carr, of course, with Howard University, Law and Victoria Burke, managing editor of Politics365.com. Folks, would you hear the chief make those comments? Protesters fired back saying, it's not our job to want to go get a job with the police department. It's your job to get officers to behave properly and do their job.
Well, that's kind of not his job. I mean, their job is basically to maintain order in this society. He's not wrong in terms of calling for people to get involved. I think, though, that he probably overstates the case in terms of what the police can and can't do.
And also, he's the one that needs to get involved, okay? It's these police unions that go silent when the NRA says, okay, everybody have a gun. The police is police on the front line. They don't get involved in politics. They don't get involved in social issues. They don't get involved in this discussion until there's sort of a problem. I mean, the only thing that the police really get involved in is defending other police when somebody does wrong. But why aren't they out nationally and saying, look, NRA, you've been wrong about this gun thing. We're on the front lines fighting it. We as police are against that. I mean, that's the first issue they should get involved in.
But it doesn't make him incorrect. So what he's saying is that if you want better police on the police force, then young people who care about that and care about the way the streets are policed need to take an active role by trying to get those jobs. I watched his second in command on Sunday at a town hall at the Potter's House, who was talking about how he has to go really to every city, every state in the nation in order to recruit when there are people who are able to do the job and serve who are not willing to do it there. So that is a way that we can become involved,
but
and I agree,
of course. The
problem
is not too few police. We have over 1 million peace officers, sworn, deputized
quality.
Police officers in the United
quality.
States. Right. But we don't need more cops.
Quality of the police officers.
As Baton
we don't
Rouge.
Need young, untrained police officers.
How about that?
We need good, quality police officers who have the requisite education level.
But here's the fundamental problem, though, when you talk about that. Even when you have good quality candidates who become police officers, there still is a culture that says,
right.
The moment you walk in,
that's right.
We protect each other.
Right. That's right.
And so when cops complain about no snitching on the streets, the biggest and the baddest no snitching policy exists in police departments.
That's right.
And so that's part of the problem. And so I've heard from people who say, yeah, I would love to do that, but the problem I have is, your culture is a problem.
Well, but there's no accountability.
No.
Absolutely zero accountability.
And there won't be any either. I mean, Roland, we're trying to address a structural problem with situational solutions. The function of the police in the society is not to do what Chief Brown is trying to gesture toward. And you're right. You're right, Lauren. I mean, if he were heroic, he would take a different stand. However, putting that uniform puts you in a straitjacket
exactly.
Until the people who control things
well, actually,
say, now get out there and call
for
peace.
He has now got the national bullhorn. If there was
he
any
does.
Time to say something,
this
it would be
time.
Right now.
This
I mean,
time.
It's perfect for him.
But also, we played the video of Nakia Jones the other day where she said, look, if you don't want to serve in this community, take the uniform
thank
off.
Thank you.
That's right.
You need a chief to be saying that.
That's right.
You need a police chief saying,
that's right.
I hear you. And you know what? There are some people who have no business being on the force.
Yes.
I don't want them on the force.
You know, but
just like when I criticize bad teachers,
yes.
I say I don't want bad teachers, bad principals, bad school board members,
no
bad politicians over school boards.
No question.
I say I don't want bad journalists. Every industry
right.
has a core group of people who have no business being in that industry.
Yes.
The problem is that police officers don't want to say that. And if the chief comes out and says that,
yes.
I believe there's more trust for the community to say, oh, now
this,
you get it.
Is that
this
true?
Is
Do you
like,
think
this,
that's true?
Well,
I mean,
this
you're,
institution,
you just
though, this institution, though, law enforcement in this country is as strong as the Catholic Church. This is like the Catholic Church.
Oh, no,
section. I mean, this is something where we cannot even break sort of the most basic
right.
mores of the culture of policing in the United States.
That's right.
And even though, you know, I think that everybody at one point or another has been a fan of cops,
mm-hmm.
Had cops help them, et cetera, and so on. I mean, the idea that we can get no accountability
right.
in this profession,
and
no other profession,
and
except
kid.
This one.
And the thing, the reason, we'll talk about it a little bit in a moment, the reason I believe that people keep getting it wrong when they criticize Black Lives Matter is because what they're saying is we want accountability. And the problem, Monique, is when you have officers who refuse to want to even acknowledge
right. Right.
the need for accountability.
Some officers, but you've seen recently there have been several specials where officers were highlighted who were coming forward and talking about the culture that exists, talking about the kind of quotas that they have to meet for arrests and how they pick on those who are most vulnerable in doing that. Because if you've got to meet a certain quota, if you're pressured as a young officer, then you're going to go into poor communities, you're going to go into LGBT communities, you're going to pick on people in places where you know you can get to them easily. They're not going to go downtown New York City, Manhattan. They're not going to go to upper business districts in Chicago. They're not going to come down to Capitol Hill. That's not where they're going to go.
Even though we know we got drug use in those particular places
exactly.
there.
Yes,
Lauren,
absolutely.
Real quick before I go to my guest.
Well, I was just going to say the stop and frisk class action lawsuit taught us that. You can stop 600,000 people and no accountability, and then one of the cops testified, they made me do it. They made me go to Black and Latino areas with that age group between 18 and 30 to stop those people. It's crazy.
I want to go to the phone lines right now. We have Dallas State Senator Royce West, who joins us right now, one of two African Americans. Actually, he's by Skype, one of two African American state senators in Texas. Senator West, you served previously in the Dallas County DA's office.
That's correct.
You've had to deal with police officers taking the stands, taking the stand in cases. You've had to prosecute some of these cases, and I'm sure you cast a wayward eye at some of those. Do you believe that part of this issue is it requires leaders to actually say, I don't want bad cops on my force?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. The fact is that you know who the bad cops are. There's still that code of silence that runs through some of these police departments throughout the United States. And their colleagues know who the bad cops are. The question is whether or not, for the sake of law enforcement, the law enforcement profession, whether or not they will reveal that without suffering any ramifications from their colleagues saying that they're snitches and things of that nature. Prosecutors know when they get ready to prosecute a case as to whether or not it's a good case or not based on the credibility of the police officer. You can sit down and visit with those police officers and know whether or not you have a good case, know whether or not you have a good police officer that's made a good case.
When you look at these protests, when you look at the demands of protesters, I still fundamentally believe what they're saying is, if the Declaration of Independence said all men are created equal, Black folks have, since we've been here, tried to force America to actually live up to its ideals on paper that it doesn't actually practice in reality.
Well, I mean, you know, the reality is this. We have got to continue to push. You know, all of the complaints about, you know, Black Lives Matter, recall, those were some of the same complaints about the NAACP. In terms of when it was leading the civil rights charge, which it continues to do so, but it was when we were looking at some of the housing discrimination and some of the voting rights acts and things of that nature. And so we shouldn't be deterred by the name calling about Black Lives Matter. The fact is we need to be supportive of it, make certain that if there's a misstep that we turn around and make certain we improve upon that and continue to move forward. We should not be deterred by people calling out Black Lives Matter, but we need to continue to make certain that we're taking positive steps in order to heal America.
Senator West, President Barack Obama will be speaking at the Morton Myerson Symphony Center today, along with former President George W. Bush, who is a resident of Dallas. What do you want the president to say today to Dallas and to America?
Well, again, we need to make certain that we have the president here, and I'm glad he's here, and I'm glad that the former president will also be there, as well as some others throughout this country. The president needs to continue to call for healing in this country. We need to make certain that hopefully he will talk about the balancing of not only the loss of life of these fallen warriors here in Dallas, the police, but also the loss of life in Baton Rouge and St. Paul and throughout this particular country. There is a racial problem in America, and he has a megaphone to continue to talk about what that problem is and also to encourage us to sit down and try to get it right. I'm hoping that the National Governors Association, you know, it's been real quiet. The National Governors are meeting in Iowa. No one has said anything to them about what they plan to do or whether or not this issue is on their agenda.
I want to play something here. Dr. Brian Williams, one of the surgeons who tended to the officers in Dallas, spoke yesterday, and it was amazing to watch the reaction. And I want to play that for you right now.
I stand with the Dallas Police Department. I stand with law enforcement all over this country. This experience has been very personal for me and a turning point in my life. There was the added dynamic of officers being shot. We routinely care for multiple gunshot victims. But the preceding days of more Black men dying at the hands of police officers affected me. But I abhor what has been done to these officers and I grieve with their families. I understand the anger and the frustration and distrust of law enforcement, but they are not the problem. The problem is the lack of open discussions about the impact of race relations in this country. And I want the Dallas police to also see me, a black man, and understand that I support you, I will defend you, and I will care for you. That doesn't mean that I do not fear you.
That was powerful to hear a surgeon say, because what happens is there's this assumption in America that, oh, if you're African-American and you've gone to school and you dress well and you don't get in trouble, everything is fine, you have no reason in the world not to fear the cops. Here's a surgeon who says, I will support you, I will back you, but also I fear you.
Correct. I mean, you know, Roland, what has been occurring over this country for the last couple of weeks now are stories by African-American men to one another about incidents that they have been involved in with police officers, some good, some bad, as it relates to stopping and searching them. Not only African-Americans, but Latinos. I was at the police vigil last night, and a couple of Latinos talked to me about how they were stopped, even though they were there honoring the police officers that had fallen and being supportive of the families. They told stories of being stopped by police and being talked to rudely and not being told why they were stopped, and then having their cars searched and things of this nature. And that conversation is going on across America in terms of interactions with police officers. But there are also good stories that are coming out in terms of police being in the communities. So we know that there are good stories and there are bad stories.
All right, Senator West, we appreciate you joining us right here on TV One. Folks, still to come in our two-hour special, who is to blame for five officers being shot dead in Dallas, according to some conservatives, is Black Lives Matter. We'll talk about that next. News One Now on TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Update in Baton Rouge, the DA, Hiller Moore, revealed he has close ties to the parents of one of the officers accused of shooting Alton Sterling. That officer is Blaine Salamani. That's why that DA is actually stepping aside in the case.
The best way that I can maintain that trust is to request another prosecutor be appointed in my place. I have reached out to representatives of the Sterling family, the community, faith-based leaders, and law enforcement to provide all of them with the reasons for my recusal.
Of course, the U.S. Attorney's Office will also be leading the investigation of this case as well. Folks, of course, we know that Michael Xavier Johnson is the lone individual that Dallas police say was responsible for killing five police officers as well as injuring seven others. His parents have spoken out about his actions. Here's what they said.
I don't know what to say to anybody to make anything better. I didn't see it coming.
Oh my God, he was a good son.
He was a good son.
I love my son with all my heart. I hate what he did.
Did he ever talk about any of his experiences in the military that maybe made you question that something happened? Was it the war? Or?
I don't remember anything.
I don't remember anything about it. The military was not what Micah thought it would be.
It disappointed him.
He was very disappointed. Very disappointed. But it may be that the ideal that he thought of our government, of what he thought the military represented, it just didn't live up to his expectations.
I want to go to our panel here. Man, to listen to those parents react the way they did is difficult because they're having to experience the pain of the aftermath of the actions of their son, who's now dead.
Yes.
And that is always
the case. They had no idea what was going on. It's like the Orlando shooter. I mean, he had seen his father the day before. And even though I really feel sorry for them from a personal standpoint, I do have a hard time believing that they had no idea that he was troubled, at least, you know.
There's a pattern there. Even Timothy McVeigh, in his testimony in Oklahoma City, talks about the impact of killing people overseas coming back here. Right. When you're a young black man like that, I mean, he's not Joe Walsh that can call for a race war on television and go home. He's not Rudolph Giuliani who could preside over Patrick Doris mind getting screwed and then come back and talk about this. This is a young black man who has been sent overseas to kill people, who comes back here, who sees this Black Lives Matter formation emerging, who says, I want to do something. Now, when you put the, you personalize that, you're right. That's a problem. But just the fact that we saw that footage on this area, you know, we're not seeing that. They're going to demonize him. And if those people keep talking, they're going to demonize them too.
In fact, Monique, I read other stories where even where he worked, they said, look, he came to work. He was on time. He was a hard worker. His co-workers didn't see anything, so I'm not shocked or surprised that his parents would say that.
And we're putting it together after the fact, and we're trying to say what it may have been that was the trigger for him, but that doesn't even have to be the case. And what we have to realize as a nation is that where mental illness is concerned, if you're not a trained professional or if no one's even talked to you about what to look for, you will not see it. Yes, there may have been things there if he was in counseling. There may have been things there if he was speaking to a pastor or to a counselor in a system that was provided by work. But if he's never presented with any issues, then of course, these parents, there's grief everywhere on all sides of this issue.
Hold tight 1 second. We come back, folks. Black Lives Matter. Folks are assessing blame, saying they are the reason for what Michael Johnson did. Also saying they are a terrorist group, hate group. Why all of a sudden are they attacking folks who are exercising their First Amendment rights and demanding accountability for police? We'll break it down next on News One Now on TV One, our 2 hour special. Dealing with the issue of black and blue in America, the race crisis.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
The last 3 years have seen constant attacks on Black Lives Matter activists by any number of people, but it is especially the case in conservative media. That continues in the aftermath of what took place in Dallas, also as protests rage across the country. Here is a snippet of what is being said about Black Lives Matter.
And I do blame people on social media with their hatred towards police. I do blame, I saw Jesse Jackson, I think it was on Fox the other night, calling police racist without any facts. I do blame former Black Lives Matter protests. Last night was peaceful, but others have not been, and we've heard the pigs in the blanket. This has to stop, Harris.
It is time for this nation to stand up with one voice and to condemn and shun this movement called Black Lives Matter. I would like to see the Southern Poverty Law Center place Black Lives Matter alongside those other hate groups that were mentioned, these black nationalist groups, the Black Panther Party, the Nation of Islam. It doesn't mean that those organizations will go away just because they're on that list, but what happens is people start to delegitimize these movements and marginalize them. This movement needs to be marginalized. We have looked at this stuff. We have peeled back the layers. We've looked at the data. We've looked at the research. None of their false narrative about the use of force about the American police officer can be proved.
When they talk about killing police officers.
But they don't.
When they sing, they sure do. They sing rap songs about killing police officers, and they talk about killing police officers, and they yell it out at their rallies, and the police officers.
Mr. Mayor,
please let me finish. And when you say Black Lives Matter, that's inherently racist.
They're not protesters. You know, these are thugs. They're rioters. And I'm calling out the media saying, quit claiming that these rioters are peaceful. They're stomping on our flag, figuratively and literally, shouting death to cops, celebrating violence.
Now, here's what's interesting. The reality is that if you actually stepped on a flag, you actually can, because it's called the First Amendment. You would think people who love the Constitution would understand that. But I want to go to Monique, Greg, and Lauren to hear the Rudy Giuliani's of the world who defended police officers and Amadou Diallo.
Right.
Who defended police officers with stop and frisk and shooting and killings. Oh, no, no, they're just a racist organization because simply saying Black Lives Matter is racist. And I'm sitting there watching John Dickerson allow him to continue
right, exactly.
on Face
At
the Nation.
At some point, it's the fault of the people who invite these people on, okay? Because you know what Rudy Giuliani is going to say. There's no mystery.
And that's why you invite him.
That's right. There's no mystery as to what he's going to say. That's but it's interesting to watch conservatives in this moment who talk about less government and too much government in people's lives and the Constitution is in their pocket. How many members of Congress have I run into bragging about the Constitution being in their pocket? Then when we see people demonstrating, exercising their First Amendment, rights of peaceable assembly, all of a sudden there's a problem because they disagree with those people. So they believe in the Constitution up until the point Black Lives Matter shows up.
This isn't about the First Amendment or the Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. This is about 13, 14, and 15. Criminality was baked into the Constitution after the Civil War. 100 years later, we fought what they call the Second Reconstruction. What you're seeing with Black Lives Matter in many ways may be the Third Reconstruction, or to borrow from Beyonce, the Third Formation. In other words, we're still working on this project called America, and it has never been institutions that have advanced that project. Right. It has always been in the streets. What they're reacting to is their incapacity to control this movement of black people.
And in fact, if we actually went back and stripped away time in terms of 21st century and 20th century,
that's right.
What you were hearing from Sarah Palin,
right,
Rudy Giuliani, from Bill O'Reilly,
that's right,
from Dan Patrick, literally is the exact same thing, Monique, that was said about the NAACP,
yep.
SCLC, and SNCC in the 50s and 60s. Yep.
It's the same thing, but now the tail is wagging a dog on a much bigger microphone. And we have to realize that it's not just in some part media to blame. This is media-driven propaganda to get out a specific message in the face of all the facts to the contrary. Facts have nothing to do with the way that these shows are being cast. And it's to feed a populist base. The people who are sitting on their couches aren't picking these people to come on.
That's right.
They have an opportunity to spend the 5 minutes putting facts out there, or they have an opportunity to put ridiculous, ignorant, biased, racist,
entertainment journalism.
Factually incorrect.
Entertainment
journalism. It's not entertaining. It's dangerous.
I think she used the appropriate word when she said propaganda. Because when you begin to establish the facts, because again, I get narrative. I've been in media since I was 14 years old. I've studied this. I majored in this. This is exactly what propaganda does. You keep repeating the same narrative. And so when Bill O'Reilly and Sarah Palin and Rudy Giuliani and Glenn Beck down the line, Sean Hannity, over and over and over again, terrorist group, killers, want to see cops killed, even though when they keep saying, and here's what's interesting, I even talked to some of the people who is St. Paul, Minnesota. Folks on the ground told me that whole pigs in a blanket thing was actually the protesters joking with the cops.
Well, I mean, but
now, that was interesting.
No question. Roland, what you framed it, brother. When you go back to 1919, the thing was so bad that Johnson named it the Red Summer. All you gotta do is read the newspaper accounts of the time. It's the same thing. It's propaganda. You characterize these people as terrorists. You come forward into the 1950s and 60s. It's the same thing.
Right.
You're right. You take the dates off. But what we're seeing is a failure of the structure now. Mm-hmm. This demographic has changed. America.
And they're mad that they cannot control
exactly.
the narrative.
Yeah.
Because
can.
With social media, you
There's
can
no
bypass all of these networks.
Exactly.
You can bypass the newspapers. Mm-hmm. And people say, oh, I don't even have to watch you. I can watch it live while it's happening. Unfiltered.
Yes.
And that's really what's driving
them
crazy.
And there's no mentioning of any of the statistics that The Guardian, The Washington Post did on police brutality and
of course not.
Officer involved. That's just not even in the conversation.
But social media has. And in fact,
right,
social
exactly.
media is filling a void that during the civil rights movement and during the previous era, the black press served.
Right.
That's why TV1,
right.
that's why News 1 Now is so important. Because in 1919, they could write that in Chicago Tribune. We had the Defender.
There you go.
That's
but
exactly
we can't
right.
sleep on the media construct. We
oh,
have
absolutely.
A Republican nominee
right.
that
right.
was media propping.
And who also says that I will be the president of law and order,
yes.
which is exactly what Nixon said
yes.
and what Reagan
George
said.
Walsh.
Hold tight 1 second. We keep talking about community policing. Why do you have this divide? Well, in the next couple of segments, we're going to talk about how we can actually achieve that. Examples of community policing where folks are doing well with the community when they communicate with the community. That's next right here on this 2-hour special, Black and Blue in America, the race crisis right here on News 1 Now and TV 1.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
How do we fix this problem when it comes to trust between police as well as the community? That really is the most pivotal question that we can pose that deserves a conversation and an answer. Joining us right now is Jim Bierman. He, of course, is the head of the Police Foundation, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting innovation and improvement in policing through its research, technical assistance, training, and professional services. Also joining us from St. Louis is someone you've seen before. He's Reddit Hudson, co-founder of the National Coalition of Law Enforcement Officers for Justice, Reform, and Accountability. Also is a former St. Louis police officer and was still joined in studio by attorney Monique Presley, Dr. Greg Carr, chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, as well as Law and Victoria Burke, managing editor of Politics365.com. So I want to start with you, Reddit, because you served on the, first of all, how long were you a St. Louis police officer?
5 years.
You saw a lot of this stuff up close and personal. And one of the things that I've heard you constantly talk about, which we discussed in the previous segment, and that is this really is an issue of accountability when you talk about the protests that are taking place across this country against the police.
Absolutely right, Roland. When you talk about building trust, what we need to see on our side is accountability. When you see Eric Garner murdered in broad daylight, and then Pat Lynch, the police union boss from New York City, up with his chest out and his chin up, talking about the great job he did. That's what drives the anger you see on the streets. You see that brother down there in Louisiana, Baton Rouge, Alton Sterling, murdered on camera, and no call from within law enforcement for accountability, no grieving from within the law enforcement community for the loss of his life. He's a citizen of the United States. He is a member of our communities. You have to have some kind of reciprocity when it comes to how we value each other's lives when tragedy happens or when lives are taken wrongfully. And I think that is the ground floor of trust between police and communities, and we've never had it in Black communities or brown communities or marginalized communities across this country. And that's the place that we have to get to believe that we can, if those people from those communities who serve in law enforcement and in the criminal justice system now unify ourselves and challenge this system, remake it, not reform it, because it's designed exactly as it was designed to function. This is how it's functioning. We have to rebuild and remake it so that equal treatment under the law is a reality and not just a narrative.
Jim, I want to go to you. You're a former police chief. First of all, how long were you a police officer?
33 years in Southern California. The last 13, I was a police chief.
When you hear what Reddit just said, it's very interesting, because when I hear the Dallas police chief, David Brown, talk about desiring of the community to embrace police officers and support them, what Reddit is saying is the community also wants to see cops have some empathy and compassion when somebody is gunned down, even when it's very clear that they were in the wrong. What often happens is the response from police is simply defend, deflect. Your thoughts?
Well, I think he's right, and to a large degree. One of the things that the culture of policing in America does not easily support is for the police to say that we're sorry, that we made a mistake, and that this is a absolute tragedy when somebody loses their lives. And I think he is reflecting not only his experience as an African-American, but his experience as a cop. He understands the policing culture. And we have got to find a way in America for police chiefs, sheriffs, line-level officers, everybody in the world of policing, to be more human. And that when somebody loses their life, especially at the hands of the police, it may or may not have been a justified act on the part of the police officers. But why can't we say that this was a human tragedy? And if there's a mistake, we're going to try to fix it. If somebody needs to be held accountable, then we're going to hold them accountable. But at the end of the day, a human being lost his or her life. And that is a tragedy not only for them and their family and their friends, but it should be a tragedy for the entire community. And when we can't come together and just acknowledge that, then we are going to have problems and we're never going to bridge this divide.
So, Jim, what it sounds like, what you and Reddit are really saying is that if you can't even start with the acknowledging of the loss of a human life, you can't even get to the rest of the conversation.
Well, I think that's right. I had an argument one time with one of my bosses many years ago after an officer-involved shooting, because I wanted to go to the paper and say, I am sorry that this happened. Ultimately, this was adjudged to be a justified shooting, but somebody lost their life, and I wanted to say that. And I had a massive argument with somebody, I don't want to name them, but about whether or not I should do it. I did it anyway. I was, you know, probably not supposed to, but in my community, we needed to acknowledge that maybe the cops did what they had to do, and that was how the system judged it, but still somebody lost their life. And we needed to acknowledge that, and I thought that the police department needed to acknowledge that we were sorry that somebody lost their life, that it came to this, and that as human beings, that we had to find a better way than resolving these kinds of things with violence.
Yeah, and the rest of the conversation is about the institutional racism that's at the foundation of our criminal justice system. I thought that Chief Brown, when he spoke, when I saw him over the weekend, missed an opportunity. Of course, we all sympathize deeply with the loss of life in Dallas and those officers who tragically lost their lives. We, as a nation, mourn them. But in his remarks, I thought he missed a real opportunity to understand that we cannot, at this point in our nation's history, given what we see on these streets, fail as a nation to address the root causes of the discord that we see. And much of that has to do with the institutional racism that runs throughout our criminal justice system at its foundation and runs throughout police culture, in many cases from coast to coast. We have to be ready to acknowledge that. And the people who are in best positions to do it are those in law enforcement and criminal justice service. We can call it out. We know it's there. So many of my colleagues have talked to me very frankly about it. And you're going to see increasingly, I believe, more and more people ready to have that conversation and do the hard work of remaking a justice system that's operating at a moral deficit and has been for generations.
Gentlemen, hold tight 1 second. When we come back, we're going to be joined by a couple of other police officers. One of those officers, he has some 930,000 followers on Instagram. You might have seen his videos doing the double dutch with kids. He understands how officers must connect on the streets with residents. So we'll have that conversation next, right here on this two-hour TV One News One special. That is Black and Blue America, a race crisis. We'll be back in a moment.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
I want to continue our conversation when it comes to the issue of community policing. How do we bridge this gap between various police departments and communities of color? Joining us right now is a police officer out of Little Rock, Arkansas, Tommy Norman. You guys might have seen some of his videos on Instagram. Go ahead and roll a video, folks. You might have seen him doing the double dutch, all kinds of stuff along those lines. Here's one of the video. I'll talk right over it. And you see right here all the kids running up to his car. So take a listen.
How y'all doing?
Tim.
What's up, KJ?
I knew that was you. I said, I hope this is normal.
Everybody was impressed with you yesterday because you were using your manners. You were being really nice. And you told me you love me. You look just like your mama. Okay.
Yeah, Pampy.
Where's everybody at? Where's CeCe and the crew at? No, they gone.
Yeah.
Mama, she just called me. Come here. Come here.
Folks, if you go to Tommy's Instagram page, you'll see a lot more videos like that. Tommy, first of all, thanks for joining us on TV One. What's interesting to me, first of all, to have a police officer with 930,000 Instagram followers. We've seen many of these videos. What has been the key to your relationship with the community where you work?
Well, I grew up in the community. Roland, first of all, I'm honored to be on your show. I grew up in the city. So I've been a police officer for the last 18 years. So what better way to give back to the area that I grew up in than to be a police officer and make a difference?
The thing is, when you watch these videos, clearly there's a relationship there when all of a sudden you've got kids running up to your car.
Right. Well, you know, that comes with a lot of hard work, a lot of spending time out of your patrol car and really making a difference.
When you talk about making a difference, what advice do you have for other officers who don't have the same relationship? Because I believe that's really one of the fundamental problems when you don't know who's in the community. I grew up in Houston, Texas. We had police officers who were in my neighborhood. They knew the wino down at the gas station. They knew the guy who was selling stuff out the back of his car. They knew the can man who went around the neighborhood digging through trash and getting cans. And so when you don't know folks, then all of a sudden you're really a foreigner in a community.
Right. Well, as I said before, you had to get out of your police car. Sitting in your car, driving up and down the main thoroughfares, you're not going to make a difference. Get out of your car. Walk the streets, sit on some front porches, get to know people. The more you get to know people and get to know their stories, what's going on in their life, how are the kids doing, how's work going, how's school going. But you got to be out there every single day. You can't skip a day. You have to stay committed. And more importantly, Roland, it has to come from the heart.
Is Jim still with us?
Yes, I am.
Jim, when you hear that, when you see the kind of relationship that Tommy has with folks in the community, I mean, that speaks volumes. That's actually what community policing is.
You're 100% right. And the real question is, how do we clone him and put about a million of him out there? Because that is exactly, so the key to this, did you hear those kids when they said, as they ran up to his car in that video, we hoped that was you? So think of the difference where these kids are running to a police officer as opposed to running away from a police officer. And that comes from a relationship. And this officer understands the true purpose of him being there. It is almost a spiritual connection between what he does as an occupation and the people he serves. And I have no doubt, I don't have the honor of knowing him, but I have no doubt that he can defend himself and he would do whatever he had to protect the people in his community or himself or other officers. But at the same time, he can interact with kids on a level that is meaningful and is sincere and speaks volumes about what cops in this country ought to be doing.
I want to go to Rashern Baker. He, of course, is the county executive in Prince George's County, Maryland. Rashern, when you listen to officers like Tom and you hear that, how are you trying to drive that in Prince George's County when it comes to that kind of relationship?
You know, it's just the same thing that we're doing in Prince George's County. It's a little different because we're 500 square miles, but it's the same thing. You've got to have a relationship with the community. And in our case, what we tried to do, because, you know, Prince George's County had a history of police brutality, mm-hmm. especially against African-American males. When I came to Howard in 78, you didn't go to Prince George's County. You know, that was the first thing they told you when we got off the bus at Howard, don't go there. Mm-hmm. We've changed it over the 20 years because we focused on the community and doing just what that officer did in Little Rock. But I think then it goes more, because once you have the relationship, the police officers with the community, then you have to bring services into those mm-hmm. communities. So it's not just enough for our police to carry it. It also means that we have to go in, provide economic development, provide all the social things that we need. That's what we've tried to do in Prince George's County. And then one thing, if I could say this, Roland, you've got to focus on race. Race is a big part of this, and we have to be open and talking about race in this country.
Got to go to a break. We come back. I want to go to Reddit in St. Louis to find out concrete examples from him of places where you have truly effective neighborhood policing, community policing, where they have been able to bridge this gap between the community and the cops. We'll continue right here. News One Now on TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Folks, still joined by Jim Bierman of the Police Foundation, as well as Tommy Norman, a police officer in Little Rock, Arkansas, Reddit Hudson with the National Coalition of Law Enforcement Officers for Justice Reform and Accountability as well. Reddit, I want to go to you real quick. Places that are doing a great job of community policing.
You know, I heard that question posed before the break.
Give me one second, Reddit. We got an audio issue here. And so I want to go to Jim. Jim, can you answer that question for me? Then I go to Reddit.
Sure. Well, there are places all over the country. You know, Dallas is one of those places, ironically, given all that's happened there, that has made great advances. They've had a history of problems, and the chief there is trying very, very hard to make changes in that. So I would point to Dallas as one. Camden, New Jersey's another one. There really are all, they're all over the place.
Reddit?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yeah, we got you now. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was racking my brain over the break, and I know that since Mike Brown was killed 10 minutes from my house, there have been many efforts on the part of police departments around the country to move in a different direction. I honestly, Roland, can't specifically name one that has been wildly successful with community policing because the departments and the officers on the ground would have to invest themselves in it. I know here in St. Louis, when I was on, community policing was the model. And myself and others on the department were out to engage the community in a proactive way and not always in a punitive way. We would talk and get out of our cars and build those relationships. And it's always puzzled me, for the black officer in particular, where we were raised by a community, loved by a community, guided by a community, and directed by a community, to then leave that community, go to the police station, fill out the application, and be right. accepted in the academy. And now all of a sudden, I'm no longer part of that community. That's insanity. I think at the heart, we have to realize in America, we are the community.
Ready, hold tight 1 second. I'm going to hold all of you over for another segment. When we come back, we'll continue this two-hour special, Black and Blue America, the race crisis. When we come back, we'll talk about the issue of white acknowledgement, a part of the problem, right here, News One Now TV.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Welcome back to this two-hour special of TV One's News One Now, looking at these critical issues we're facing in this country. We continue to be joined by Rashawn Baker. He's the county executive from Prince George's County, Maryland. He joins us here in studio. We have Jim Bierman with the Police Foundation via Skype from England. We also have Tommy Norman, a police officer, Little Rock, Arkansas, who joins us as well via Skype. And then Reddit Hudson, of course, he is also a former police officer and with, of course, the Accountability Organization focused on police as well, joins us from St. Louis. Also in the studio, we have Monique Presley, attorney at law here in D.C., Dr. Greg Carr, department chair of the Afro-American Studies for Howard University, as well as Lauren Victoria Burke, political analyst and writer for NBC Black. The last couple of segments, we talked about community policing, trying to bridge this gap. And Tommy, I want to start with you, then I'm going to go to Rashawn. In order for it to be effective, what you do, to me, there has to be an absolute commitment from leadership to do it and stick with it. Lee Brown was the mayor of Atlanta, later went to Houston, later went to New York. He has been a major advocate of community policing. Is that the most important thing, driving that from leadership, making it clear from the top on down, this is how we're going to operate?
Yeah, our chief of police, Mike Davis, is a big advocate of community policing. We kind of followed his lead. He started out here as a patrol officer, now he worked his way up to the chief. So he's a mentor of mine, and I've always lead as a community police officer.
Rashawn?
It's that's what it is. It's got to come from the leadership, and not just at the police department, but the county executive or the mayor. They've got to set the tone and then carry that way down to the beat officer to know that this is important, and the people that they're going to promote, whether they're lieutenants or captains, are going to have to carry that out. But it's the leadership starts at the top.
Lauren, to your point earlier, it also has to be a case where departments are not looking at police departments as revenue sources, because there is a lot. The part of the deal with community policing is that there are sometimes folks do some stuff and you don't arrest them, you don't write a ticket. That's you right. Say, look, don't let me catch you doing this thing again.
Right.
It's a relationship thing.
Exactly. And there are a lot of departments, and we saw that in Ferguson. One of the investigations of the Ferguson Police Department revealed, of course, that they were mostly collecting tickets and writing tickets and really collecting revenue for the city, and that was a really big problem. And I think the underlying problem, too, is that we do hear so much about community policing, but as the county executive already said, I mean, it's like the resources are not given to that from the top, and a lot of the folks at the bottom, particularly the police officers, can't really control that part of the equation.
And Greg, what happens is community policing becomes, oh, well, that's soft policing, when really the citizens are demanding hard policing.
Well, you both just framed it. I mean, Philander Castile had 4 dozen stops for broken taillights or things like that. You know, the Ferguson report, which came out last year, talks about this as a source of revenue, as you said. Prince Jones, why do you follow him through 3 counties into Virginia and Prince George's County? The question of profiling lies at the heart of this problem. Community policing is fine, but if you're going to stop people from selling bootleg CDs, next thing you know, you're dead. You're absolutely right. You got to let some of that behavior go. That's not your job.
It goes
you're
back
not
to broken windows and that whole thing.
Exactly.
Right.
So many takeaways from that last segment. The reason community policing is important is because there is a humanization gap going both ways. Police are not seeing people of color as human beings. The people of color who distrust the police rightfully are not seeing police officers as human. What Reddit said is so true. You have to, when someone dies, acknowledge the loss of a human being. When you look by comparison at the Johnson family, they're mourning because their son killed police officers. They are acknowledging humanity. They are grieving what happened. The police consider themselves to be a family. If somebody in your family does something wrong, acknowledge what they did and mourn it. But the law, of course, will try to keep the police from saying something.
Jim, final comment on community policing.
Well, I think it's about relationships. We've just heard that through all of these comments. It's about relationships and human beings treating each other the way they would like to be treated. We should adopt the golden rule of policing in this country. Police people the way you want to be policed.
Reddit, 30 seconds, final comment.
We got some work to do, man. And the country needs to be prepared to do the hard work of dismantling institutional racism so that we can all be equally valued as citizens here.
Rashern, 30 seconds.
I think we have to have an honest conversation about race, both from the police standpoint and from the citizen standpoint and from those who are in power, executives and mayors.
Tommy, final comment.
All right, so those police officers out there today that are watching this, park your police car, get out of your police car, and as a police officer, rolling your badge should have a heartbeat. Treat people with respect, love them, care for them, and we can all change this together.
Tommy Norman, we appreciate it. Thank you so very much for your great work. Jim Bierman, thank you very much as well. Reddit Hudson, thank you very much as well as Rashern Baker. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Folks, one of the other issues that we have seen is that white Americans are realizing that what African Americans have been saying for quite some time has actually been happening. A couple of pieces have been written that really caught my eye. One of them was on redstate.com, a very prominent conservative website. And Leon Wolf is the managing editor. This is what he wrote. He said, they look like a scenario that has played out all too often that the white community either doesn't believe ever happens and minority communities believe is a systemic occurrence. And they look, most importantly, like many other scenarios in which officers have skated either scot-free or with a slap on their wrists. He basically acknowledged that when watching these videos, these things have actually happened. He said, and we're seeing it for the first time. We got to stop running away from it. Matt Lewis, a senior contributor from The Daily Caller, wrote this here. In the era of Facebook Live and smartphones, it's hard to come to any conclusion other than the fact that police brutality towards African Americans is a pervasive problem that has been going on for generations. Seriously, absent video proof, how many innocent African Americans have been beaten or killed over the last 100 years by the police with little or no media coverage or scrutiny? Joining us right now is Tim Wise. Tim has been on the show before. He is a frequent speaker across the country on the issue of bigotry and racism. And Tim, this is critically important because when whites begin to acknowledge that, whoa, this is real, it changes their view of police, of believing everything. That's one of the reasons why I believe you see so many young whites who are a part of these Black Lives Matter protests, because they're saying, I'm not sticking my head in the sand like my parents have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. I think young white folks have an awareness of the extent to which people in authority abuse their power. Now, historically, younger people have always noticed that, right? I mean, you go back 40 years ago, and it was younger folks then, including younger white folks, who were often allying themselves with the civil rights struggle, et cetera. So I think young people have an innate sense of injustice that sometimes society sort of wrings out of us over time, and we become more inured to that pain or more sort of oblivious to it. But I think what's happening right now is that people's awareness is certainly being raised. I think the history that Black and brown people have always known as a matter of survival is something which is slowly beginning to filter into white America. And hopefully that will allow us to sort of break out of this matrix-like obliviousness where we've been on this, you know, blue pill for all of these years, not seeing the things that black and brown folks have seen, so that we can come together in solidarity and do something for the benefit of the whole country.
Tim, hold tight 1 second, going to break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation as to whether or not do white folks get it when it comes to police brutality as it relates to African Americans. Also, we'll have a discussion, should President Barack Obama pay a visit to Baton Rouge, to Minnesota? He never went to Ferguson, never went to Baltimore. Should he go to these places like he's going to Dallas? That's next, News One Now on TV.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
It took me a long time and a number of people talking to me over the years to begin to get a sense of this. If you are a normal white American, the truth is you don't understand being black in America, and you instinctively underestimate the level of discrimination and the level of additional risk in a way that you have to have a corrective. But the minute you start getting the corrective, so Black Lives Matter in a sense, and I like your point, mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter too, would in fact try to be a corrective which initially people reject because it's not in their world. So to the degree that if you're an African American, you are, you know, raising your teenage boys to be very careful in obeying the police because they're literally, their lives are at risk and they can see it on television. At the same time, if you are a normal Caucasian, you don't see that. That's not part of your experience. And somehow we have to be able to have a conversation and a dialogue where the mutual experiences start getting us to say, gee, if that's true, under what circumstance can we fix it?
That was Newt Gingrich in a Facebook video with Van Jones talking about this whole issue as resulted from the protests of Black Lives Matter. Tim Wise is our guest. We're also joined by Eugene Craig, vice chair of the Maryland Republican Party. Tim, here's what I want to deconstruct that Gingrich video. Mm-hmm. I understand his point, but here's to me the problem that I have with white Americans who say, but if you could just call it Black Lives Matter too, mm-hmm. is as if they want to set the terms of the debate for black folks to make them more comfortable, as opposed to simply accept Black Lives Matter and just have the damn debate.
Right. Well, the word too is implied in the title, and it always has been. I mean, the point is, and I've said this many times, America has a long history of saying all and not meaning it. We said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and we did not mean it, or at least we acted as though we didn't. So what black folks are saying, and what those of us who are not black but who support the movement are saying, is that sometimes you have to specify that which has been left out. That's why we have Black History Month, not because we don't want to do white history. We got that covered. That's the point. We're trying to do this other thing because certain things are ignored. And the idea that we can't get our head around that is part of our problem as a country, that we have so ignored the black and brown experience that when someone says, hey, wait a minute, we need to talk about this, it's like, well, that's reverse racism. Well, you're ignoring us. You're denigrating us. No, we are trying to add to this thing called all what really constitutes all. And until white America is ready to accept that, we're not going to be able to move forward.
So, Tim, how does white America have this conversation inside their own community?
Well, I think we as white parents, those of us who are, have to have a real honest conversation with our kids about both the history and the ongoing reality of racial inequality. 75% of white parents, according to the research, never talk about race and racism with their kids. On the flip side, about 75% of black and brown parents do. So that creates a real dichotomy, right? If black and brown families are having this conversation and white folks are not, then it's really hard for us to come together. It's like having a book club where, you know, half the room has read the book and the other half has read the preface, right? It's really hard to then get together and have a conversation when entire millions and millions of people are acting like this doesn't really affect them.
Tim Wise, always good to talk with you, brother. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you.
Eugene, I want to go to Eugene. Craig, I want to go to you. So when Gingrich made that comment, again, we see this a lot of times where whites are desiring of black folks to make them as comfortable as possible having discussions around race. Mm-hmm. When I'm saying, it ain't my job to make you comfortable about an uncomfortable conversation.
Absolutely. And it is an uncomfortable conversation. But I do think the thoughts that Speaker Gingrich exposed this weekend is a step forward. You know, you have a situation here where you have a prominent white conservative that is acknowledging that that white America does not go through the same particular reality and experience that black America does. And I think it's that beginning, it's the beginning of a conversation that needs to take place. I think we're steps away from, you know, a full-on debate about it, a fair debate about it. But I do think that we're moving, and it's a good first step.
But here's a piece, Greg. I recall when he was Speaker of the House, he often met with black columnists.
He did.
Newt Gingrich has talked about this beforehand. So for African Americans, they're saying, Newt, we've heard you talk about it before.
Yes.
The issue for African Americans is your policies that follow the conversation
exactly right.
don't match what you just said.
Talk is talk, policy is policy. Let's be very clear about this. Well, Frederick Douglass was arguing with William Lloyd Garrison in the 1850s about this moral suasion. Here's my pushback to Tim Wise. It isn't implied, too. The framework is wrong. Black Lives Matter comes from the same sentiment as reparations. We are human, so now let's deal with this as humans. These folks are trying to reconstruct an American narrative by presuming that there's something original in this process. that is good. Right. No. Look, brother, when you see Alva Brazil get killed in Houston, there's a moment when there's a brother in a white t-shirt who just drops down and just weeps, and then he just starts pounding the ground.
Yes.
That's what black people's reality, brother.
I mean, I think
this ain't about trying to make white people feel good about that.
The idea that people don't know or that somehow something has to be explained, I'm not buying into that. Yeah. I think a lot of people know exactly what's going on historically, but they've chosen not to do anything
Eugene
about
Money.
It.
Well, I will say this. The policy is catching up with the rhetoric. You had Senator Rand Paul, who during the middle of Ferguson, from a whole other country, took time out to actually acknowledge what was going
on. Rand Paul had conversations.
But he's also
his party controls the Senate. Where's the policy?
He's also, well, there are criminal justice bills moving through the Senate.
Unfortunately, Senator Tom Cotton is blocking them.
And I call Tom Cotton out every chance I get.
Yeah, but he's blocking. It ain't moving.
Well, it's moving. The votes are being whipped
If it's moving, it got lead feet. Monique.
Right, no, I just don't want us to fall for this argument anymore. We're in that same bait and switch, red herring, talk about the title instead of talk about the substance thing. These are talking points. And again, media highlights people who act like they don't understand or like the two needs to be explained. Right. I don't have to explain anything to anybody.
Now,
I matter.
Speaking of mattering, I want to go to this issue, and I've heard a lot of discussion on it. President Barack Obama going to Dallas for memorial service. He's offered several statements when he was overseas. He's coming back from Spain to be in Dallas today. Is it time for this president to go to a hot spot?
Yes.
Absolutely. To go to Baton Rouge.
To
go to, because he didn't go to Ferguson or Baltimore.
He can't do it.
He's the president of the United States. He's the most powerful man in the world.
He can't do it because to do it would mean that the lives of Alton Sterling and Phil Castile are equal to the lives of the five cops. That's what he can't do, and that's what he's avoiding.
No, he can't do it for the same reason that David Brown can't say what needs to be said. They're not built like that. It's, you know, politicians who make statements. I mean, he came to Howard and gave a speech, same kind of finger wagging stuff as he usually talks to black people on too. Mm-hmm. Lyndon Johnson, as far as I'm concerned, gave the greatest speech an American president gave to before a black college audience when he talked about affirmative action. Obama doesn't take risks. That's why they call him no drama
Obama.
He doesn't
take risks for African-Americans.
He doesn't take risks for us.
He takes risks for Hispanics. He takes risks for LGBT
community.
He takes risks for other communities.
It's a matter of
he
us
will not
take
this risk
for
whatever reason. But if you're in only the last 6 months of your presidency, okay, I don't know what's stopping you. I could see if it was 2009. It's not 2009. We've had Ferguson. We've had all this other stuff. If not now, when?
Monique, should the president go to Baton Rouge or St. Paul?
If the people who work for the president think that that in some way would tremendously move the conversation forward, and his legal department is saying that it's not a risk because it's an undetermined officer-involved shooting situation, then yes. But I do know that the reasons why there hasn't been that type of presence from the highest level of our government is because when the president can't speak on the right or the wrong or the shoot, when the Justice Department is still investigating, when all of those things are happening, it looks like what he is saying is from the executive office, this was wrong, before all of the people who are investigating is saying that it's wrong. I'm saying from a policy standpoint, I understand that that is dangerous. And if I was advising, I may even have some cause to pause.
Let me tell you something. I'm a young conservative Republican, and I'm going to say this. If all lives matter, if we're going to be united in the healing of this country, if you're going to go to Dallas, you need to go to Baton Rouge and Minnesota. You know, if truly all lives matter, then all lives need to matter equally in the same value. I'm pro-life. You know, a life is lost. Your same attention that you're going to give to Dallas, give it to Minnesota and Baton Rouge. Because if we're going to truly talk about healing this country, it's a matter of you got to understand both sides. And part of understanding both sides, acknowledging both sides with the same level of respect.
Hold tight 1 second. We were in Dallas on Friday. That was a prayer service. Took place at Concord Missionary Baptist Church, where the issue of healing and how we move forward was discussed. We'll have that for you next, right here on this TV One News One Now 2 hour special, Black and Blue America, a race crisis. We'll be back in a moment.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
About 12 hours after the deadly Dallas shooting on late Thursday night, I was in Dallas where they had an interfaith prayer service at Concord Missionary Baptist Church called by Pastor Stephen Carter. African-Americans, whites, Latinos, and many others, pastors all across Dallas, to talk about healing, but also how to move Dallas forward. Here is what was said.
I want this place to shine right now. Look at this. Shine. Shine. Father, we come boldly to your throne of grace, interceding for the city of Dallas. And we thank you that your eyes are open to this city. We thank you that your ears are open to our prayers. And tonight we echo the words of David when he said in Psalm 18, a hostile world, it's real. We call to God, we cry to God to help us. From this position, he hears our call.
So when we call on God and Jesus joins our prayer in calling on God and God begins to respond by bringing us together in unity, it's time now not to go home and forget this meeting today. It's time now to loose the shackles of racism and segregation and evil and injustice and let it go. We don't need general help in Dallas. We don't need what Baltimore needs. We don't need the same thing that Sanford needs. We don't need the same thing that Pennsylvania needs. We don't need the same thing, but we want God to mix up something that's with Dallas's name on it and Dallas's church. And God, we will pull over to the side and we will wait for you to deliver that which will dry our tears, because we're gonna roll the stone away.
If we are going to experience unity and come together, understand we will not heal from what we ain't real about. And we have to keep it 100 about the fact that right here in these yet to be United States of America, we live in a country born in sin and shaping in the iniquity of racial injustice. I'll use the metaphor. When America was born, sadly, there was a cancer in America. A cancer of racism that structured into its body politic that black lives don't matter. That's why it's never been an issue about all lives mattering. It's been black lives that historically have not mattered.
As far as I'm concerned, the church has to amp up its game. Unfortunately, we've been guilty of silence. We conveniently address issues of personal piety and the sin within us, but not the sin we are in. And the sin we are in, God is displeased with injustice and evil and poverty and systemic suffering. God is displeased with racism. God is disgusted with all of that, but we have conveniently ignored that. And now maybe God will use, God did not cause this, but as Joseph told his brothers, what others meant for evil, I think God can work for good if we amp up our game.
Tonight, it's all about it, there's only one star in the room.
Yeah.
There's only one VIP in the room. There's only one hero in the room. And let's give him a standing ovation. Jesus, the Son of God. Come on, y'all.
And in our humanity, we are broken. This is not black people, this is human beings. We are broken people, which is the need of a redeemer. Because if white churches, black churches, and every church said that racism is a sin, it's a sin. And if we all agree that it's a sin, that when you have black children not getting good education, it's a sin. When you have streets and white neighborhoods that are smoother than streets in black neighborhoods, that's wrong. And we should care about that. When white police die, it's a sin. And we all should be compassionate about these things and not try to justify them. That if my people who are called by my name would humble themselves and pray, but my people, all people, realize that we've sinned against each other and that we need the Redeemer to come fix our humanity. Our humanity is broken, and we need to be able to address that.
You can be pro-black and be pro-police. You can proclaim that Black Lives Matter, and you can pray and grieve and weep with our chief of police and our officers who give their lives every day on our behalf. I am pro-black, I'm pro-police.
What is happening and what has happened over 400 years and what's happening even in 2016, it's wrong. But it's wrong across the table. It is wrong for black people to celebrate online these police officers being killed. That is wrong. And it is wrong for white people to not be sensitive to try to understand where does the hurt come from.
Come on.
It's all wrong.
It's all wrong.
And it comes with humility. And I celebrate these white leaders tonight saying that we apologize for the hurt that we see you. Man, I mean, it was like a breath in here. And I believe that that is the beginning of healing humility.
I was one of those guys who in my heart just thought, well, why would you say Black Lives Matter? Of course, man, I'm a big whole earth people. Jesus loves all the children of the world, red, yellow, black, and white. Of course, black kids matter. It's in the song. What's wrong with you? But see, here's my problem. I was that fool who does not delight in understanding, but only revealing his own mind. And I had to stop and listen to my brother who needed to be healed. And I said, would you explain to me why you're saying Black Lives Matter again and again? Why are you saying Black Lives Matter again and again? And it took me sitting down with one of my friends, my brothers, who was black, who sit there and tithe. When I'm saying Black Lives Matter, I'm not saying all lives don't matter. You care about the unborn, right? You do a lot for the unborn, right? I go, yeah. He goes, you talk about how unborn lives matter, right? When you say that, are you saying that living creatures outside of the womb don't matter? Is that what you're doing? You want me only to care about babies in the womb? Is that why you say babies in the womb matter? Because you don't think people outside of the womb matter? Is that what you're doing? And I said, no, the reason I say babies in the womb matter is because we treat babies with injustice. We're indifferent to them. We act like if they're in our way, we get rid of them. We kill them and we maim them if that's what we want to do. I don't think people value children in the womb. And as I was explaining to him why I felt like I needed to say that unborn children matter, I all of a sudden heard myself say, bro, I know why you're saying Black Lives Matter. I know why you're saying it. Because as Freddie said at the very beginning of our time together, we have a system in our country founded on the incredible Judeo-Christian ethic that we founded our country on, trusting in divine providence, where all men could create it equal and pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if you're black, you matter, you're just gonna be a slave. And that continued for a long time. And then we broke you out of the plantations, but we still kept you in a place. And I understand why people say Black Lives Matter.
First of all, I first moved here in 1993, so very familiar with the city. And to watch what happened last night unfold on television was stunning. And I got an email last night. You guys said last night this needed to happen.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah, we did. I mean, one of the first things I did, I texted my friend Mike Smith, who I didn't know at the time was on a gurney on his way to see Jesus, who's a police officer. Said, "Hey, Mike, are you working tonight, and are you okay?" And I never heard from him because he wasn't. And I texted Brian. I said, "Let's go, man. Let's be the church. What are we going to do?" And so we just said, let's get this thing together. I mean, Brian was going to do it, and it just, you know, we got assimilated in this one more time just to be God's people and to get together and say, hey, we're not going to let hate define us. We don't hate each other. We love each other, but we've not done a good job of loving other people who think hate's a solution. So let's take a stand. Let's go. That's how it happened.
On Tuesday, we cried as we watched Alton Sterling gunned down outside a convenience store. On Wednesday, we cried as we watched Philando Castillo suffered and died in his car after being shot four times. And on Thursday, a peaceful protest was hijacked by snipers who would shoot 12 officers and two civilians. Five officers would die before sunrise. It has been a difficult week. And it would be different if this wasn't the first time. But yet we've become all too familiar, whether Charleston or Ferguson or Orlando or Sanford, the vicious hatred and bitterness that we continue to see. We are living in difficult days when our young black men don't feel safe. And now our police officers don't feel safe, and we don't feel safe. And fear can be incredibly crippling. But as people of faith, as believers in Jesus Christ, we understand that when our fear tries to take hold of us, we must look to our faith.
So, Pastor Carter, did this achieve what you desired?
We hope so. We really think so. It's only beginning. Us coming together is long overdue, and then we have to begin to strategize from here. So this is the beginning, time of prayer, time of remembering, and then we'll begin to take our next steps in terms of strategizing how we really can bring healing in our city.
All right, folks. First of all, again, a great, great interfaith service there. Lots of great things said, and folks there made it clear they are committed to leading Dallas out of this difficult time. Coming up next, we'll talk about why is it after Charleston, 9 black folks were killed in a church. All the discussion was on black forgiveness, how African-Americans forgave Dylann Roof. I have not heard a forgiveness conversation after Dallas. We'll talk with journalist and activist Sean King next. News One Now, TV One.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
You, I forgive you. You took something very precious away from me. I will never talk to her ever again. I will never be able to hold her again. But I forgive you.
You know, I forgive you, and my family forgive you. But we would like you to take this opportunity to repent. Repent. Confess. Give your life to the one who matters the most, Christ.
We are the family that love built. We have no room for hate, so we have to forgive. I pray God on your soul.
Those were the words of several family members in the Emmanuel AME church shooting last year at the bond hearing for Dylann Roof, the young man who shot and killed, he murdered those 9 folks in church in June 2015. Many describe their willingness to forgive quickly as an example of great Christian faith, but others viewed it as a symptom of a society that often asks African Americans to forgive atrocities before they are allowed to grieve. What's interesting about this whole issue in Dallas, and I was there for 2 days after the fact, I didn't hear that conversation. I didn't hear, and you don't even see it. After Charleston, all you saw on every network, folks talking about this capacity to forgive in the aftermath, What's going on in Dallas? Writer and activist Sean King wrote this in the New York Daily News. Quote, when white people suffer any form of violence, it's just common sense, and you don't ask them if they have forgiven their victimizer. You particularly don't see this ridiculous question being asked of white people when a person of color was responsible for the violence. Well, Sean King joins us right now via phone from New York City. Of course, we still have our panel as well, Eugene Craig, Monique Presley, Greg Carr, Law, and Victoria Burke. Sean, the reason I want to talk about this here, because again, I'm comparing two atrocities. One, 9 people killed in a church in Charleston, 5 officers gunned down in Dallas. And it's a totally different reaction and tone that you're hearing from the city, but also on national mainstream media.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you played those clips, I have a double mind about it, because there's a part of me when I heard that, those clips, it's beautiful. And black, the black ability to absorb the pain of America and continue to move on is profound. But then when you look at the pressure to do so, it's troubling. And what we see all across America, and we saw this in an interview with the mother of Philando Castile, just 2 days after her son was murdered, she's being asked on the news if she forgave the officer who killed her son. And it's a preposterous question. The man has not sought forgiveness. He hasn't acknowledged any wrongdoing. Her son has not even been buried yet. She hasn't even received a police report. And unlike the victims in Charleston, she looked right in the camera and said, no, I do not forgive the man who did this. But it was ridiculous to even put her in the position to have to answer such a question. And the same thing happened with victims in Charleston. And while it's powerful to hear, it's painful, because anytime you see atrocities or massacres or mass killings that kill white folk, you don't hear that. Like I said, after 9/11, on 9/12, nobody was asking folk if they forgave Osama bin Laden. After the San Bernardino shooting, nobody was asking those victims' families if they forgave Saeed Farouk. And nobody's asking that in Dallas. And it's not that forgiveness is a bad thing. I'm a Christian. But it takes years and years to reasonably process the grief of murder. And black folk are often expected to do it within hours or days.
Here's a quote. Here's a quote on black forgiveness from journalist Stacey Patton. Quote, black pain is only heard after forgiveness is afforded to these white perpetrators. The media and others celebrate the traumatized family members' ability to respond to this latest heinous crime with compassion and love. Monique.
I don't want what those families said in court to be disrespected or to be denigrated or to be ignored. It's not a black ability to forgive. This happened at a church. They are Christians. It's straight scriptural, Matthew 6:15, forgive others so you can be forgiven. It's a necessary step in recovery after any kind of loss or trauma. So whether people can do it early or whether they can do it late, I don't think they were forced into it. I recognize that there is a greater debate in terms of expectation, but I thought that that was a beautiful example of an African-American church rooted in love and leaving toothless what that still living perpetrator had done. We have a very different situation in Dallas, where actually judge, jury, and executioner took care of all of it on the streets of Dallas, where the person who, the shooter who killed the police officers were concerned. And I know that's a separate topic, but sometimes there is an easier hurdle where you don't have to stare down the person who has injured your family. So that has shaped the debate as well.
You know, you're obviously sort of playing above with those, you know, obviously those acts of forgiveness after the murders in South Carolina. But I found it one of the most disturbing things that I've ever seen in a long time, that people right after, I mean, Sean hit the nail right on the head. The story became about not Dylann Roof, his actions, what he did. Right. It became about, ooh, look at this, these acts of, these gracious acts of forgiveness. But I thought it was, I thought it was disturbing.
It's media irresponsibility. Part of grieving is being able to grieve in your own time and being able to grieve through your own process, not it being forced to shove down your throat for ratings and to change a narrative.
Right.
And I think it's media irresponsibility and the herd mentality of the media. And I'll take it a step further. You know, I do commend these families because, quite frankly, if that was one of my mom and my aunt that was, you know, murdered in that church, you know, my God's a God of justice and mercy, and I'm going to be waiting for that that good Old Testament justice side to fall down that murder.
I don't condemn them, and I don't commend them, and I don't talk about components of a system absent the larger system. Douglass said this 150 years ago in his July 5th speech. They that carried us off captive required of us a song. In other words, the only way America can sleep at night is if the Negro, the magic Negro, continues to forgive these crimes against humanity. And as Malcolm X said, in the case of Dylann Roof, you're speaking a language he doesn't understand. That is as a consequence of being socialized in a country to say your rage is not legitimate. Right. You are subhuman. Exactly. Now, what if they did not forgive them? What if in Charleston they said, no, we don't forgive him. We don't forgive him. In our righteous Christian indignity, they would have been okay with that. Now let's flip this. What if other people now said, no, I don't forget the police? Now what happens? They're labeled as agents and targets of hate.
Right.
They're labeled as people who don't have the capacity. Wait, this country has never.
Exactly.
Bill Clinton wouldn't apologize.
That's right.
Barack Obama.
And their greatest fear, is the lack of forgiveness, which is what Michael Johnson is.
Yeah.
I mean,
Sean,
so it's
that's the greatest fear.
Sean, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, the double standard is obvious, and we can celebrate and or at least acknowledge what happened in Charleston, but I think it's clearest when you see Philando Castile's mother, the same week that officers were killed in Dallas, she is grieving, and then she's even asked to condemn the shooting in Dallas, and even then, in a separate interview, and her thought was, again, what does that have to do with me? I am a grieving mother. And again, that would be like asking the families of the Dallas victims, do you speak out on Amadou Diallo or Tamir Rice or Rakia Boyd? What the hell does that have to do with them?
The reason I believe this conversation was important is because, to Greg's point, that is my fundamental problem. I believe there is a different expectation for African Americans.
Yep.
That we are expected to absorb a hell of a whole lot more than anybody else. And Sean, you're right. I watched that interview with Castile's mother. And she said, I don't know what happened in Dallas. Right. She said, I haven't been watching the news. She said, I haven't even seen my son's body.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so here she was being asked about something in Dallas.
Yes, yeah.
And she said, I haven't even seen my own son.
Yeah.
She said, I'm trying to get justice for my son, and you asking me about something in Dallas. That's like trying to ask the folks in Dallas about a bombing in Turkey.
Yeah.
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 Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Sean, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important, even in this difficult time, and I acknowledge the sensitivity of the pain that so many people are experiencing right now in Dallas, in Minnesota, in Louisiana. But it's important for us to have these tough conversations, to call out the double standard, because if we're going to grow, if we're going to improve, which we are so resistant to in this country, we have to have these tough conversations, and those of us who have a voice have to say and call out. Particularly, and I agree with the thought that it's media irresponsibility, we have to say, stop asking these folk, days after they lost their loved ones, if they forgive the people who victimized them. Because we don't see that happening anywhere else. And again, yes, we can acknowledge the beauty and the heart and the soul of folk in Charleston. This is no diss on them. It's this continually putting people in position to rush through their grief. And if we got historical about it, again, and people hate for us to go back to slavery, it goes all the way back to slavery where day after day after day, folk were put in the most grievous positions, be it seeing their children taken away from them or dealing with physical pain and trauma, and immediately being forced to overcome it that day, go back to work, do what you have to do. And so this peculiar demand that black folk get over their pain quickly, it's not new, it's really, really old.
Sean King, I appreciate it, man. Thank you so very much. Greg, final comment.
I was going to say very quickly, to Sean's point, you've been talking about Birth of a Nation, the new film coming out. I think that film, as you've seen, really depicts what happens when you're called upon to do that over and over again. Mm-hmm. Now that Turner's a hero. But if he were alive today, would he look closer to Michael Johnson?
Got to go to a break. My final thoughts when we come back. News One Now, TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
So, folks, why do we do this two-hour special? Frankly, because we are unapologetically black. We refuse to allow other media to set the tone as to what is happening in this country. The first black newspaper, Freedom's Journal, said in 1827, "We wish to plead our own cause. Too long have others spoken for us." Here at TV One, we're not interested in CNN or MSNBC or Fox or ABC or CBS or NBC speaking for us. We can speak for us and by us. The issues we discuss in the last 2 hours are critically important to moving this conversation forward. If other networks want to engage in loud, shameful discussions that only serve a purpose of going viral, then go right ahead. I'm not wasting my damn time with those conversations. What we require is action. What we require is accountability. What we require is for folks to actually fully respect African Americans as 100% fully free Americans. The black experience is simple. We have always tried to force America to live up to its own ideals that it wrote down on a sheet of paper. Frederick Douglass said it. Ella Baker said it. Ida B. Wells Barnett said it. Robert Abbott said it. Ethel Payne said it. Lerone Bennett said it. A countless number of African Americans over the last 397 years have said it from the first time slaves touched this land in 1619. The reality is this: we will not stop speaking. We will not stop putting the pressure on. And if you are afraid of accountability, well, then tough luck, because we understand that black lives do matter, and we don't have to add two on the end of it, because to make you feel more comfortable, accept the reality that we will keep this focus on this issue, we'll keep challenging, keep prodding, and doing our job as soldiers without swords in the tradition of the black press. If you missed this two-hour special, it will re-air at midnight to 2 a.m. tonight right here on TV One. I'll see you tomorrow.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.